Welcome to the Yokoji Zen Mountain Center podcast. Every month, we share at least one new talk on the practice of Zen Buddhism at zmc.org/podcast. You can also find us on iTunes, Spotify, and all other podcast apps. If you find these talks to be valuable, please consider supporting Yokoji by donating at zmc.org/donate. We rely on your support to continue sharing this life-changing practice. Thank you. We hope you enjoy the talk.
Good morning, afternoon for those in Europe, or evening. Today, I want to talk about Kong Basso's illness, also about the training period, which Tim Heffernan's going to be doing. Or leading as head trainee. So, the case 36 of the Book of Equanimity, Shishin's book. Preface to the assembly. Though you investigate apart from mind and consciousness, there is still this. Though your study leaves the road of common and holy, you are still in danger. The iron barb is jerked out of the red-hot forge. Though your tongue is like a sword and your lips are like spears, it is still difficult to open your mouth. Without damaging the spear point, please try to present it and see. The main case. Great Master Basso was ill. The temple priest asked, Osho, or priest, how is your health these days? Basso replied, Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. The appreciatory verse. Sun-face, moon-face, stars fall, thunder crashes. With regard to shape, a mirror is selfless. The ball on the tray rolls by itself. Don't you see? Before the hammer, an anvil. Gold of 100 temperings. Beneath scissors and a ruler, a bolt of silk. Again, just to reiterate, with these cases, you know, usually you have the preface and the main case there. They're usually written and, say, collected by the author of the book. The poems, in this case, are done by another person. Bansho, I think, in this case. Tendo Wanshi was the person that did the first part. So, you know, why am I bringing this up? You know, this really stood out to me, this particular case, because of Master Basso's, you know, just is just very straightforward answer. We are faced with a three-month training period, which is usually they're not so easy if you're there for the whole 3 months. It's, you know, and if you're not used to training periods, even being away for a week and doing those things, they're not so easy either. I was noticing that I was working up for it too last couple of days. You know, just preparing my own mind because I've got to be present for those 3 months. And I know anything can happen in these training periods, you know, anything. You know, it can be external, can be internal, can be people, can be things going on at the center, and there can be ramifications. One thing that training periods are not is they're not just of trying to keep a level of peace going on. It might be peace between people. But part of it is to really be yourself in whatever way, just in the same way that Master Basso is saying in this particular case. You know, it's usually after about two weeks is that the schedule then begins to grind on you a little bit. It's unending. It just keeps on going. And it addresses those usual things that we have as human beings, you know, is lack of sleep, not so much nowadays, food that we don't necessarily like, a schedule that keeps us occupied. There's not much free time in that period. And then obviously there's extra duties that need to be done in various ways to keep the place going. And so this sort of builds up. Now, the interesting thing is, so those first 2 weeks, you know, people are fairly peaceful and then begin to irritate one another. And then the last 2 weeks, then people relax because they know it's going to end. And it's almost like every single training period is like that. But this kind of training period has been going on since the time of the Buddha. How, why? You know, they did this six months on, 6 months off. So a 3 month wet or rainy season, and a 3 month dry season, and those were punctuated by traveling between places. Obviously, these training periods became easier to do once they got viharas or training centers together, and they put them in there. And obviously, when they did the training periods, then they added a lot of rules, you know, because people being people will do what people do, you know. And if you read the Vinaya, is that some of these are fairly shocking, what some people would do. So anyway, these training periods. So one, we go back to the case. We look at a couple of things. The first thing is that this interesting is that the preface is fairly militaristic. Why is that? You know, for say Zen practice. When this collection was compiled, this was the time of Genghis Khan. So, you know, you can imagine why they're appealing to a more militaristic way of looking at things. One of the beauties of this book was that it was actually sponsored by a Khitan governor of China at that time, of northern China, called Yalu Chusai. And he was a Buddhist. Apparently he was a pretty impressive figure. He was about 7 foot tall, apparently, a bit like Obaku we talked about last week. But he did a lot to mitigate the atrocities that were being done against the Chinese people at that time. So this book is also another aspect of his goodwill towards the people at that time, and to bring out some of the things that would help their heart in whatever way through a very difficult time. Because obviously, you know, people like Genghis Khan did not like the Chinese very much. He didn't like city dwellers. You know, he liked migrating. He didn't really bother if cities disappeared, really, except for taxes. So you look at these things. So he goes, the iron barb is jerked out from the red hot forge, and this is really talking about our training. You know, is that it's not just a little bit of I'm going to be mindful today and just at these moments in time. It's you really enter in, and your own behaviors then really begin to rise up to the surface. But then, in rising up to the surface, which is, you know, what the training period's about, then they can be seen and they can be dealt with. They can't be suppressed. It comes to the surface. I was talking with Yamakawa Sogen Roshi when he came up here, and we were talking about training, and I was saying, well, you know, we don't hear much about dealing with emotions in Japanese Zen. And he said, well, you know, what happens is that quite often in many monasteries is that these emotions do come up, and then people try and suppress them. Some of them, they drink and do things like that. But the thing is, it's meant to be there so you can actually feel these things. And then you've got an opportunity to deal with them. The Japanese deal with emotions different than many Western countries do. And if you go from nation to nation within Western cultures, we deal with emotions in different ways. And, you know, their thing is that you sit still in the midst of these things and you learn to see that they're part of the human condition. And you take care of it yourself, basically. So that really is that fire that comes up. And as we know, emotions, you know, greed, anger, ignorance, fear, all of these things are very powerful energies. So how do we actually enlist those in terms of practice and turn those energies in so that we can actually use them as energy on a daily basis? Another thing that happens with these training periods is that we learn to police our own energy too, so that it's sustainable. And a lot of those extraneous ways that the energy sort of bubbles over and goes begins to be more contained so that it can be used, so that we can use that over a period of time. This is, you know, this is the process of training. Eventually is the greed, anger, and ignorance, and, you know, it's a lot more than that. They become more, you know, energies that are available to us, and there's not the shame and pain that goes around those things. You know, they definitely, to a certain degree, become tamed in a positive sense. Not that they don't occur. It's that, you know, anger cuts away bullshit. We realize that's what it's there for. Or meeting of somebody who is dangerous, you know, and that those kind of things. Greed is that we learn to experience that and see that it doesn't matter how much we have, you know, it's just like for myself, is that I am so greedy, I want everything and I want it now. When I really open up greed to its biggest part and seeing as though everything is here now, then fine. You know, you see the use of these things. And on that level. And in Buddhism, we have that thing is that the three hidden virtues, greed, anger, and ignorance. You know, at first, they're enemies. We try and get rid of them. In time, we enlist them. You know, ignorance is, you know, it becomes apparent is that it's not that I'm trying to avoid looking at something. Ignorance is just at the basis, there is far more that I don't know than I actually do know. And that's a beautiful thing, is that then learning can continue from here on and until the end of the universe, basically, is that from this ignorance or the unknown, all kinds of creativity then can come out. But if we know everything, then it's really hard to be creative. We just go down the same old roads there in that respect. You know, and then what I'm trying to say here in terms of practice, I don't mean like just training periods at the centers for each one of us, whatever sphere we're in, is that you can practice alongside us wherever you are and go, okay, for these 3 months, I'm going to do a little bit more. I'm going to specifically look at this for this period of time. Or you can even go, okay, I'm going to ramp it up for a week, you know, in my own daily life and see what actually happens there. And so then you have these periods of more intensity, which are very helpful in terms of really rooting in thusness or in this moment in time and being able to sit still in the midst of all of these emotions that arise for us as human beings, you know. And then it's important on the other end is then to chill down. You know, I mean, that's what they're doing with sports people nowadays. You know, is that they have these periods of intensity, then they have the cooling down periods of rest and recuperation, and then they start up again. And so that they don't just get burnt out over a short period of time. But that is really for each one of us to determine. It's not like it should be like somebody else's. You've got to see your own rhythms. That's part of knowing who you are as a human being. Part of the practice is we know who we are and begin to work with that. You know, as simple as you do enough of this so-called introspection, you see, Well, under these circumstances, that's what I do. I don't need to take it seriously, you know. And these other ones is that, you know, usually when this happens is that I usually shut off there. So let's just be open at this point and see what can be done, you know. So again, these training periods, if you do them at home, is that then, again, is that it begins to enliven your own life in that respect. And it needs to be done at your own pace. So we look at that, and again, the training periods, whatever we do, even outside of training periods, he goes, though you investigate part from mind and consciousness, there's still this. Is so that for many of us, you know, we look at the patterns of our own minds. We look at the basic clarity of our own minds. We look at where our minds like to go, or our thought patterns like to go. And in time, a lot of this is mapped out. And still, we have to function in the world as we do. All of these things are like a training period in that way that never ceases. There's always an opportunity to train in that way. You know, it's like in the Heart Sutra where it starts talking about in the lists where it goes on, no eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. We begin to see as we say things, as we do things, these things are apparent to us. We see the one who is always functioning no matter what. And then we see the one who's always at ease in the background too. It's not that we're split up in that way. It's that these things develop through practice so that we can be present again to whatever's occurring. So we look at this. There's, you know, the case starts with attention. Like every single case starts with attention in this book. It says, Great Master Basso was ill. Attention, pay attention to this. Because, you know, we can look at these things and we can go, well, these were these guys that were, you know, in this case, I think it's the end of the 8th century. I'm just picking up what Shishin said on that one. But Basso was in the Rinzai school, basically, but he was pre-Rinzai. So there's Basso, Hyakujo, Obaku, Rinzai in that one. He was apparently a very impressive figure, you know. And in this case, he was ill. How can somebody that is, you know, vigorous and strong, how can they be ill? A lot of people ask that. Now, you have to remember is that Zen practice isn't about being perfect or a perfect one who is always something. You know, is that you enter it or in practicality, you enter into whatever is there. You know, so here, the temple priest that was there says, you know, how are you? How are you, Your Reverence? And this happens in any kind of any kind of circumstance in our life. How are you? And you see that concern that comes from a person. You know, I mean, it's not always that they're aggressive with somebody to prove their understanding of Zen, which, you know, less and less I get interested in that thing, is how it functions is far more important. How are you doing? There's a lot in there where you feel for somebody. Now, Basso, being a teacher, you know, he could have gone, you know, I'm okay, you know. But that wouldn't have been much of a teaching. He puts the barb in, which is like, and again, the barb in the iron thing, he says, sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. What the hell's he talking about? You know? Now, you have to really sort of look at this. I mean, in our own life now, because these words echo, they echo down, just like we hear things from Alexander the Great, we hear from great religious figures from many, many years ago. But they're really talking about living in itself, not the life of their time necessarily, unless there's some cultural elements in it. But he goes, sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. So, again, if we are fairly in touch with our environment, we see that the sun comes up in the morning, and then sometimes we can be fairly specific with that. And then it goes across the sky. And then quite often they're not there at the same time, although sometimes they are. Then the moon comes up, and that dominates in that way, usually in the night sky. In the day sky, it doesn't dominate that much. So again, you know, those are natural parts of our life. Just like sickness and wellness are parts of our life, they come and go. You don't really need to pay this much heed. But do we, you know, do we pay that much heed? He adds the barb of putting Buddha, you know, Buddha on it. So that changes it somewhat, you know, Buddha, you know, sun face Buddha. What the heck is that? You know, so when you are well, you know, we tend to radiate, don't we, somewhat, you know, some people glow. Buddha, meaning awakened, we're definitely awakened as a sun face, as being radiant in that way. Also, when we're not doing too well, you know, it's more like the moon, although it reflects light, it's not so much coming out, just like when we're sick in that way. You know, I remember, you know, my grandfather, he died of stomach cancer when he, you know, was in his 80s, and I went to see him just a day or two before he died, and he woke up for a short period of time. I said, "How are you doing, Granddad?" And he said, "I mustn't grumble." And there was just his face had color in it. The rest of his body was, you know, it was just like white, you know, dead kind of thing. "I mustn't grumble." But that tells you a lot too, you know, tells you a lot. How do you do when you face difficulties, health difficulties, etc.? Is it a big drama, you know, like some of these things you see on TV, or, you know, you see these things where all the soldiers go around the guy that's dying, the captain or whatever, and the war's still going on in the background, you know, that kind of thing. Is it like that, you know? I mustn't grumble. It kind of shows you is that everybody has this. Sun face Buddha, moon face Buddha. Everybody has this. Sometimes I appear as being sick, as the Buddha sometimes appeared as being sick. And sometimes I'm well, I'm energetic, I've got some rest. You know, these things happen. But what do we attach to those things? Do we attach a story like, well, now I'm well, this is the way it should be, this is the way a religious figure should be? You know, do we project that onto people? You know? Well, I remember somebody coming up to me, actually a couple of people over time, and go, "Oh, he's a Zen master, he shouldn't be sick." You know? And I'm just laughing to myself, you know. It's like Masumi Hoshi was sick a lot. But when he was sick, that's when he got rest. The rest of the time he was on, you know. I mean, I inherited that for a period of time until I learned a little bit about pacing energy. But, you know, first 50 some years of my life, that's the way it was. It's when I was sick, that's when I got rest in that respect. I'm not saying that's good, but that was part of a tradition that we, you know, we'd inherited. So, you know, we look at this. What beliefs do we have around sickness? You know, there's another one which, well, I can't practice because I'm sick. Why? I mean, one of the first things I learned when I went to ZCLA was we were short-handed. Now I was sick. I had the flu. I said, you know, I won't come in. I won't get you guys sick. He said, "Well, we're short-handed. We need a monitor." So they put me in the back of the Zendo, and I took some ibuprofen, and, you know, I was sitting there, and, you know, I was going, I can't practice like this. Well, I was going, well, you sat here. The only thing that's different is your energy's low, and you're sick. So I sat there, and I kind of just learned to breathe in a way that was healthy and seemed to be healing, healing me. And then I learned a lot, is that it isn't dependent on whether I'm high energy and really pushing. It's just like, no, practice is living in itself, no matter what I am faced with, whatever energy level is there. This is practice. It's not doing something else, but it's being totally whatever is there and learning to work with it in whatever way. And again, you know, that's another aspect of training periods, is you'll go through all of these different states, physical states, healthy, tired, up, down. And the neat thing with this is that then, you know, obviously as a teacher and the people around, is you see these people in no matter where they are. And then over that time, see them angry, see them sad, see them happy, seeing them all these mental states, you see, yeah, they're practicing no matter what. It doesn't matter. There's no excuse there. I once had a student, and they thought that teaching was just talking, you know. And they also thought that showing up when it was convenient was being a teacher. You know. You know. No. The teaching is the being in itself. It's just like, you know, people will come for session, but session doesn't begin when the first sitting period begins. There's all of the prep that goes in. It's all part of that practice. And part of it, again, with all of this, and it doesn't finish with the end, then there's all the takedown, and that continues. So after a while, as you begin to see that practice is continuous. It doesn't end when you leave the property. You know, I mean, you know, granted, when I leave the property, it's like... You know, and I think for most people there's that exhale of, you know, I don't have those pressures now. But the thing is, here I be. Bad English, but it's good English in the sense, here I be. This is where practice occurs, as Dogen says. When you find the place that you stand or where you are, practice occurs, actualizing the fundamental point. It's not determined on that, on physical the physical place either. It continues. But then also it's not holding on to a state of mind. You can call it a Zen state of mind, whatever that is. It's like then how do you then enter into the sphere of practice that you find yourself in? You know, when it's work, how do you focus on that and still being aware of the people around you and what's going on? When you're at a party, is that then how do you fit into that? What's practice in the midst of a party? You know, how do you spoil it with your own mind? All of these things, practice never ceases for a moment. It's always ongoing. As the one who sees through these eyes sees at this moment. And that's why Basso has this... you know, this statement of sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha is however I am at this moment in time, this is how I am. You can value it, you can look at it in many different ways, but one thing is obvious, you cannot help but be yourself right from the beginning, or your true self. And this is where practice occurs. It shouldn't be another way. Why? Because it isn't. It just isn't, you know. And that's the aspect that Maizumi Roshi would say, you know, you have to swallow yourself whole, warts and all. And then you spit out the bones, whatever, you know, whatever those parts are that maybe you don't like so much. You know? So we go on. Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha, stars fall, thunder crashes. It's a pretty impressive answer, you know. It's a pretty impressive answer, but that guy that he's talking to has to appreciate that. It may be a silence of, yeah, I see that, you know. Or it could be the silence of what the hell is he talking about. But if it means something to me, then that's exactly what I've got to work on. You know, I remember once Maizumi Roshi said a poem in my Shuso Hosen, and it took me 12 years to work out what it was. I didn't ask him about it. I just kept on working at it, you know, in the background. I just left it there. And then one day it just dawned on me, okay, oh, yeah, that's what he was saying. But if things are important to you, you'll find out. If they're not, you can drop them and let them go. You know? That's practice. If something is really important to you, that's the hook that gets you. That's the barb that they talk about. It only needs to be one thing to really bring you into your own being, or the importance of your own life and practice in that respect. You know, just like, you know, Maizumi Roshi at the end of his life, you know, all through his life, he would say, appreciate your life. And that's what it comes down to. Can you appreciate this living, and I'm not using life here, but this living, which is always ongoing, and the amount that we have in that, the amount of variety, sky, earth, you know, cities, cars, all people, all of this stuff that is constantly teaching us on a momentary basis, that may not rise up to a cognitive level, but is teaching us nonetheless, and may be useful when those times are necessary. You know, when those lessons have been learned and we use them in whatever way. So it goes on, without regard to shape, mirror is selfless. And again, really, that's our own consciousness. You know, it's not that I am this and this shape ends here, but most of our life is a mirror of the rest of the world that is coming in. You know, just in the same way as if you're watching someone and they'll cut themselves, you go, oh, you're just like a mirror. You feel for that person. Or you're looking at a sunset and you just get lost in it. That's your life at that moment in time. But usually it's me looking at that. And that's also then reflected in the way that we do meditation, is that I am doing this thing called meditation. What the hell is that? There's not an object there. You know, the world has never been split from the beginning. But sometimes it's the sun, sometimes it's the moon. Sometimes it's something you appreciate, sometimes it's something you don't appreciate. But the living is the container. That's the Buddha part, awakened. I'm awakened to it whether I like it or not. And practice occurs whether I like it or not. But then maybe we have some choice, and some of those practices may not help us that we do. So it's important in terms of practice to do those things that we really feel bring benefit in terms of our own life and the people around us in whatever way. Okay, and we go on. The ball rolls on the the ball on the tray rolls by itself. Yeah, it does. Stops at some point. But, you know, again, that's our life. It's ongoing. It just keeps on going in that way. And what we try and do with our own mind is, oh, that was a good moment. That wasn't a good moment. And already our minds are dwelling on the picture that we've got of what's ongoing. So that's part of it, is then falling into the flow of our own life. Just in the same way, here we're in transition now between a more relaxed time into a more intense time. So the thing is, you can try and resist it in your mind, but, it, you know, as the Borg said, resistance is futile. It's that life goes on no matter what. You know, so then how do I live in the midst of this? How do I live in the midst of intensity? How do I live in the midst of relaxation? It's all practice and it's all ongoing in that respect. And then obviously ask the thing, don't you see? Yeah, I think all of you see that I can see here. I don't think there's a problem in that respect. Before the hammer and anvil, gold of 100 temperings. And this is referring to Basso's answer. We always have to remember is that Basso was like us. You know, he was a human being like us. He had the same, similar shape, maybe a little bit, you know, different than each one of us. But he went through all of the training that each one of us goes through as a human being. And then out of that, he can say these golden words and phrases that he says. That's where it comes from. It doesn't happen by accident. If I don't practice, then usually realization doesn't occur. And then it's harder to talk about what is implicit in us as human beings. With allowing that tempering to occur, getting out of the way, the so-called selflessness is there, entering to it, just do it, then it has its own it has its own teaching in that way. That then we tend to absorb just by being aware of whatever we're there. And the thing that I would say about awareness is that over time it cuts through anything. So anything you regard as an obstacle, it'll cut through it, or at least it'll help you to see through it, so it doesn't remain as an obstacle. But these are the challenges that we have in our own life. Everybody has those in whatever way. Okay, and then beneath the scissors and ruler, a bolt of silk. So it's ongoing. We are making something of our life in whatever way. You know, in this way, I'm not sure. What can you do with silk? You can make some very beautiful things as far as I'm concerned. You know? I finished the talk now, so we can open it up to any questions or comments. Zach, Jozan, you're on.
Hey, Roshi, thank you for the talk. Thank you. I really resonate with Sun-Faced Buddha, Moon-Faced Buddha, and just thinking about when I first started practicing Zen, how sun-faced everything felt. You know, everything was
new. Yeah.
You know, the Shin's new, the community's new. And, and then after a period of time, you know, you start to have more difficult conversations. You start to, you know, think, how many times have I done this? How many times have I sat? How many times have I gone to the shin?
Yeah.
And for me, the experience is a little like tinge of sadness, too. The Moon-Faced Buddha is, it feels a little more, I would say, feminine and a little more sad and a little more interior. And when I look back at some of the writings, some of the poems that I've written, during the more mood-based Buddha moments, I feel like I create better. I feel like I have an energy that feels more generative.
Even
in the sun-faced Buddha aspects of my life. So I guess I'm kind of coming around to this because I used to judge the mood-based Buddha aspects of me as not good or as less than, but I'm leaning more into it now and appreciating it a lot more now, and I feel that I'm connecting with people a little bit deeper because of it. I really appreciate you bringing that up, and maybe there's a question there around how do you express, personally, how do you express both of those faces, and I guess how do you know when you're going into a season and not clinging on to it for too long. I don't know if that makes sense. But that you're talking
about. You know, I mean, it's really about presence now, you know. So it's that, you know, like emotions have their season, and it's important to experience them no matter what. But it's not saying, well, I hope I get through these soon. That may be there, but as soon as you do that, you put boundaries around it, rather than opening up to it and just allowing it to have its season, and then learn in the midst of it, see how that operates, you know, and then in time is that then you can do that. I mean, you also mentioned something that was a bit more about creativity rather than sickness and wellness, you know, and, you know, obviously it's that every part of us as human beings is valid. But it's important to learn from it too, is that, you know, with sickness, I learned to appreciate health And then when I am healthy, is then how to use that in a good way. You know, also when I'm sick, is I also learn to how to rest my body and heal my body in that process. You know, so that can occur, because if I don't do that, then the sickness just carries on. So it's just working with whatever those energies are. And you also have to look, you know, in terms of that creativity, is some of the, like, you look at some of the great bands, is that when there's tension between those band members, you know, they might dislike each other. Sometimes you can get amazing work that comes out of that, and great music that happens in that. It's not always, you've got to just make it, you know, bland, and then people can do what they do. Is you sometimes need that. You need competition sometimes. You need these things to bring out the best in people in one way or another. And then in terms of our own sicknesses, you know, whether they're not necessarily to do with physical sicknesses, our own tendencies. You know, it's just like, it's being able to see those and work with them, and then see how they're also positive in those ways too. So then we get, you know, then all kinds of things can come out in a creative way, you know. Thank you. Ranyo.
Morning, Roshan.
Morning.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, great, perfect.
I'm just struck in this koan, particularly in the appreciatory verse, by the fact that there's gold of 100 temperings and gold of silk.
Yeah.
I'm struck by the beauty that is conveyed about Basso's delivery. I don't have much more to say about that, except it touches me.
Yeah.
Jozan, also, I want to say how lovely it is to think about the creative aspects of ourselves.
Yes. Yeah.
And where that fits into the spectrum, you know, who knows? But that it's so important, and informs my understanding all the time.
Yeah, and you know,
I wouldn't get very far.
And that's the thing, you know, with creativity, is that it doesn't have to be in any particular way. You know, we try and set things up sometimes so that we can be creative. But then other times is just that they just appear through whatever's in front. I remember for me once is I had 5 minutes to get a flower arrangement together, and I'm not a flower arranger. Before the Japanese came in a coach, you know, they just like a whole coach load of them, and a Roshi was coming, and I just ran out, got a bird of paradise, just like hacked it off, and got three. Little branches, just threw it in. It was great, you know. Best thing I ever did. I had like, you know, two or three minutes. Just, and that's the thing, is how do you, and that's a great thing with Zen, is how do you use what's at hand? It's like, you know, Dogen talks about a good tenzo. Pity Tim's gone. He's going to cook, but you know, he says a good tenzo can make a meal out of grass.
Yesterday's lunch was leftovers in the soup.
Exactly. And this is the thing, is that if you're engaged in something, you can really make something out of nothing, you know, in that respect. And that appears, you know, all the way through our own culture. You know, I remember seeing Jack White on the movie It Might Get Loud. And he was talking, I think, with maybe trying to think of the guitarist, Jimmy Page, and also I think it was the Edge out of what's that one? U2. Okay, U2. And Jack White came on first. He goes, you don't need much to make a guitar. You don't need to buy a fancy guitar. So he went out in a barn that was outside. He got a 2x4. He put 4 nails in the piece of wood on one end. He got some guitar strings and he fastened them up on the other end. And then he pushed up a bridge and then just plucked a couple of strings, and then he wound copper around some nails underneath each of the strings, and then he plugged it into a guitar cord, and then he started doing slide guitar on it, and it was just like, you know, I mean, creativity. You know, a lot of people think you need the best ingredients. Just remember who you are. You know, it's that. Well, you know, perfection, you know, it's just, you know, work with what you have here at any given time. And that's the creativity of Zen, is that how do you deal with what you have, rather than going, well, you know, it's not the Kung Fu Panda thing of, well, I've just eaten, so my Kung Fu may not be the best. You know, it's just like wherever you are at any given time, you give it your best in whatever, in terms of creativity.
I have a great deal of respect for Theodore Abreu, who started El Sistema, the music system.
Yeah, yeah.
Through which my program is affiliated. And we start all our kids on cardboard instruments. And some of them really get into making it a playable instrument.
Oh, neat.
Don't. But, you know, out of anything. You know, if your drive is there, so great determination. I love that story about the guitar.
Well, you should see it. It's really good because three musicians just talking about music and then playing. Yeah. Thank you. Boy, you're quiet.
We're starting session.
Right, yeah. All right, Nicholas, you're on.
It's just that you began to talk about creativity, and thank you very much for the talk today. It was really to the point that I'll sing of a training period.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm just about to go into rehearsal again.
Training period.
It's a training period.
Yeah, exactly.
And however much preparation I make, this is the 10th Shakespeare comedy in a 10-year project.
Yeah.
And however much preparation I do, I know I've got to be ready for some things I'm never going to know before.
Yeah, I know that. I know that one. Yeah.
And I just have to pray every year that I will think of something.
Yeah, yeah.
But more importantly, that probably the actors themselves will give it to me. If I give them the chance.
Yeah.
If I let them have the space, then I will get it from them. And if I'm listening, I mean really listening, I'll get it.
Yeah. Yeah, and crashing and burning isn't so bad, you know, once you've done it a couple of times, which you probably know that already. I'll tell you a good story once. You know, we rehearsed, I think Jitsuro Roshi, when he was just Jitsuro, had come back from Japan, and he wanted to expand the way that we did the Fusatsu ceremony. So we had to rehearse this extra intonation, which really didn't blend in with the rest of the Fusatsu ceremony. And we had the head of the Soto school in America there, the bishop, and he was also been the Ino, or head chanter at Eheiji. So the pressure was getting on there. We also had the musical director of St. Patrick's Church in New York there. And so I rehearsed this, and I rehearsed this first part so much that I started doing it. And then I went into the intonations on the second part, which I knew inside out what I thought. And I just copied the first part, and it was completely off, and everybody copied me. And nobody could bring it back, and it went on for the whole thing. And afterwards, you know, I was kind of like sat on the porch, mortified because I cared, you know. And I remember the musical director of St. Patrick's in New York goes, "You really screwed the pooch," and I went. I did, you know. And then the bishop came up afterwards, and he said, "He said, don't worry, it happens." You know, so it's just these things. I was mortified, but then I learned a lot on it. It's, you know, worst can happen is a mistake, you know, but it's just a mistake. That's it. You know, if you can't do anything about it, it's just a mistake. You know.
Right. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for the talk.
Yeah, thank you. Good luck. Break a leg, what do you say?
Thank you.
Yeah.